Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group, Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com, or you can call him right now at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
We do Investing Simplified.
Well, welcome to Portland, Oregon, another wonderful day. It's going to be 80 degrees today. It's a little cloudy right now, but it's going to be 80, and you want to be doing something fun out there and go out and enjoy the day. I will just say that everything on this show has not been FDA approved, but we are here ready to go. And my name is Chuck Price. I'm president and wealth manager of a registered investment advisory firm called Price Financial Group Wealth Management. And we're on the air to answer your questions. If you want to give us a call, the lines are open. You can get in and ask a question. This is your opportunity to ask a question for free. And in studio with me today is Carl Jepson with the Warren Allen Law Firm.
Good morning, Chuck. Good morning, Kevin.
Morning, Carl. And Kevin Stange with the Baker Coastal CPA firm.
Good morning, gentlemen. Yes, not FDA approved, but you know it's good for you.
I like it. Very good. Very
and
good.
Calorie free.
Yeah, absolutely. Free is a good price. Listen, if you got a question, give us a call, 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Hopefully you've got that first cup of coffee in you. I know the three of us have, and I know that you're ready to go. I'm going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back with Kevin Stange, the tax investigator. We're going to shake things up today because it's going to be a wonderful day in Portland, and we're going to make a little change here, and Kevin, you're going to be on board.
Because I got the tallest cup of coffee, is that right?
That's it. Yep, the most caffeine. We'll be right back.
Price Financial Group Wealth Management.
The time to stop working is approaching, or maybe it's already arrived. CDs and money markets are paying only fractions of a point. How secure do you feel about retiring right now? Call Chuck Price. He's located right here in Portland, and he can show you how to increase your Social Security up to 67% using specific program rules and the file and suspend strategy. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or are close to retiring, and he focuses on how to never run out of money during retirement. Do this today. Schedule a free 20-minute retirement plan phone consultation or schedule an appointment with Chuck himself. Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. Chuck Price at Price Financial Group Wealth Management. On the web at pfgwm.com. Do you have a tax question? Here's your opportunity to ask the tax investigator, Kevin Stange, CPA and partner of the Baker Colson CPA firm. You can call Kevin at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's the CPA with the tax answers, CPA Kevin Stange.
You are listening to Investing Simplified here, broadcasting out of downtown Portland, and definitely give us a call with your questions, legal, financial, tax, 503-417-7626. And, you know, we can't go too far into today's show without talking about our good former trailblazer, Greg Oden, and his choice of NBA teams.
He was always a former trailblazer, wasn't he?
Oh, it could be, yes. I have a feeling we're going to hear more of these comments.
I give him maybe 12 games.
Yeah.
Well, he was a tall guy, but he always came up short.
Oh, yeah. Well, I wish we had a little drum roll there, Carl. You're starting off the morning good. We have a little drum roll. We're ready to go.
Very nice. Very nice. But from a tax perspective, we always do have to bring the tax perspective to everything, because even though it is the tail, it does, it's part of the full picture. So with this season of free agents choosing where they're going to play football, basketball, these sorts of things, one thing that may factor into some of their decisions that we don't know about when they're deciding is the taxation of the state they're going to be living in. Obviously, Phil Mickelson had his famous statements a few months ago where he was saying how much he was getting taxed in California and how much he would save if he was a resident of Florida. Greg Oden, possibly that might have factored in, choosing Florida as opposed to another place. I know Dallas was in the running. I forget what the third team was, but obviously Texas doesn't have a state income tax either. But let's take a look at one scenario here. Back in, I think it was April, Darrell Revis of the Tampa Bay Bucks, he was choosing whether to sign with the New York Jets or with Tampa Bay down in Florida. And just by choosing Florida over New York, same contract structure, by choosing Florida, he's saving about $1.3 million in taxes per year.
Not to mention he was leaving a sinking ship.
That's true, too. Yeah. Yes, very true also. So it's interesting how pro athletes get taxed.
But over $1 million might just make you want to think about making a move to sunny Florida.
That is true.
That's why most of the pro golfers live in Florida, by the way. Single reason, yeah.
And then the weather after.
Well, the weather, sure, but that extra 10% doesn't hurt either.
Exactly. And that's, $1.3 million on a $16 million salary. That's no small peanuts we're talking about. Another example is Joe Flacco, highest paid NFL player ever, making $20.1 million per year, signed with the Baltimore Ravens, Maryland, state income tax, as opposed to Drew Brees, making $20 million a year down in Louisiana, New Orleans. And the difference between those two states is about $500,000 more in Drew Brees' pocket than Joe Flacco's pocket. So, that's a small.
Are you talking about $500,000 total, or actually he ends up $500,000 net more than Flacco, even though Flacco got $1 million more?
He gets $500,000. He pays $500,000 less in taxes.
Okay, less.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly. So.
Wow.
Yeah. So anyway, good stuff.
That's some serious money.
To know that these things do go on. And so Greg Oden, who knows what factored in his decision? I have a feeling he was looking to get another ring on his finger, and it's
another.
Well, yeah.
When did he get his first one? Did he get married?
I'm assuming it's jewelry and stuff.
Oh, okay.
Stuff. Yeah.
Because I don't think he got one at Ohio State. I don't think he won the national championship.
You're right. Yes. Yeah. No sports rings.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. A lot of people retire in Florida.
Well, that's true. You know, I think Miami's looking at getting another ring and hoping they can bring a big guy into play.
That's right.
Maybe 10, 15 minutes a game. Because that's really about all he may be good for. And if he lasts, like I said, if he plays 10, 15 minutes, he lasts 12 games, I'm going to be shocked.
Yep, that's right.
He's an injury waiting to happen.
When you got a chance to make $1 million, you might as well pull yourself together for another year or two and try to do it.
Yeah.
All I can say is ouch.
Yeah. Well, you know, ouch is for the Seahawks and the NFL, because there's so many guys getting injured right now. Not a good thing.
Yeah. Which, by the way, Seattle is one of the few teams that does not have a state income tax. You've got the Florida teams. You've got the Texas teams. You've got Seattle in Washington. Anyhow, changing topics, let's take a look at a potential scenario in the new Obamacare for small employers and employees to consider as the rules become more clear and as we're trying to figure out, how to implement this, what decisions to make. Do you offer health insurance to your employees? Do you not offer it? And as an employee, it's going to be interesting, especially when you're working for a small employer, which is a organization that has under 50 full-time equivalents. It's going to be interesting, the decisions that are going to be made in the future. Here's one scenario where it may be beneficial for the employer not to offer health insurance. It may be more, I should say, more beneficial to the employee. And that is when you have a middle income earner, and that if the employer offers single coverage and they offer a plan to this individual, that individual either has to accept that or they get no credit through the exchange. If they do not accept the single coverage and they go to the exchange, they're not going to get any of the tax credits or any of the subsidy help. And so if that employee wants to offer, wants to accept family coverage, then they're going to have to, under that plan, pay the additional cost to the employer to get the family coverage. So in a scenario where the employer decides not to offer a health insurance plan to any of their employees, that same employee could go to the exchange and get subsidized health family health coverage for less than what they may pay for adding the family addition to a single plan. And the problem with the first scenario is if the employee is offered coverage, single coverage, and there's an option to add family coverage, then the employee's family is not eligible for credits at the exchange. So if that option is available, you have to go through your work to get the coverage.
The only comment I got to make about Obamacare is to tell you how great it is. All the Democrats voted to not have their staff and not be on it. So what does that tell you? I mean, if it's so damn good, why isn't the Congress and their staff on it? And why are they trying so hard to not be on it? You talk about a bunch of hypocrites. Every one of those guys that are in there that voted to not be on it, what they say that we have to be on, that tells you the kind of people they really are.
I wasn't real sure where you stood on this.
I know, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely not an Obamacare supporter, that's for sure.
It's going to be interesting to see how these next couple years play out. One of the things that I find a little misleading is the huge grants that the federal government is giving the state exchanges to subsidize all of this setup and the first year or so. And then after that, those grants go away. I believe Oregon was getting $150 million.
Yeah. Have you seen all the ads Oregon's running on this healthcare exchange thing? I mean, they're running ads, and I know how expensive ads are on TV. They are putting a lot of dinero out. They even produce little songs to do it, and mm-hmm. I don't know if the federal government's helping them do that, but my gosh, that's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. And when those grants go away, the theory is the insurance carriers will charge a fee to help make up for the cost of the grants that aren't being paid to them. And of course, we all know that gets passed down to the employer and the employees.
One of the other problems, Kevin, is that I live in Clark County, and in Clark County, the insurance commissioner, I guess, has to approve the plans in each state that is available in each county or each area. And I know in our area, there's only one company that's approved. Everybody else, you know, Kaiser isn't approved. A lot of other places are not approved. Only one place, and I think it's LifeWise, which has like 6,000 members in Clark County. I mean, hey, we got a problem.
They've got a lot of work ahead of themselves.
Yeah, there's a lot of work ahead.
That squared away, absolutely. So, changing topics one more time here, let's take a look at a scenario that may hit most of us during our lifetime during taxes, and knowing these rules or knowing how they are interpreted is, I would say, very important and could be very costly if you don't know them. And these are the hobby loss rules. So if you have a normal business that you have as a self-employed individual, or you're an employee, and maybe on the side you do something else that brings in some income to you, is that a business or is that a hobby? And the number one factor to look at is your intent. And of course, Carl just lights up over there.
I'm just trying to figure out how to make money doing all that other stuff.
Carl loves legal definitions. What is you, intent?
I'll tell you what.
What is?
I know somebody who a few years ago invested money into bullet making, and he made a tremendous amount of bullets, and he has made a really great investment because we all know the cost of shells have went up tremendously. So, you know, that was a hobby that he had that has turned out to be quite a lucrative type business.
So there's a default litmus test that is going to allow you to determine if your business is your activity is a business or a hobby. And the reason this is important is a business, if you show a loss, you get to deduct that loss. If after all of your income, you have more expenses, you get to deduct that loss or carry it over to the future years.
But you can't do it year after year after year, right?
Well, we'll get to that.
Okay.
We'll get to that. And if it's a hobby, you can only deduct losses to the extent of your income. In other words, you can only deduct expenses to the extent of your income. You can't take a loss. And the litmus test is, and this is misinterpreted many or misunderstood quite often, is if you have a profit 3 out of 5 years, by default, you are considered a business. You have a profit motive. You get to be treated as a business. If you do not have a profit 3 out of 5 years, this is what's misunderstood. It does not necessarily mean you are a hobby by default. And so that's the key thing. People say, well, I've got to have a profit 3 out of 5 years. Well, that's just a safe harbor that says if you make that threshold, that standard, then yes, you are a business and you get to deduct those losses. But if you don't, then you have to, then we go into facts and circumstances, and then that's where you start looking at, are you running this as a business? What's your expertise in this area? Do you have a proper business account set up, a proper legal entity set up or not? Those type of things all get looked at. And, you know, one thing is commingling your personal expenses and assets with your business expense and assets. You're really not running it like a business should be run so that you can identify what your expenses are and so on and so forth. And you can show loss after loss after loss year after year, but if you don't show activity or a plan to get out of that loss, then you're probably looking at a hobby. So,
you know, it's an interesting thing because there are people that I've known who have been, you know, very well-paid professionals in whatever it was that they did, and they started out as a hobby with things. Like, I know a fellow who actually went and became essentially a master craftsman, and he would build, he went to like an apprenticeship in like Scotland or something like that. And anyway, learned how to build, you know, amazing furniture and things like that, and, you know, like antique-y looking stuff. And then all of a sudden, you know, people wanted to buy that stuff. And you know, he kind of found himself making money when all he really wanted to do was sit in his garage and shop and you know, smell the wood. So maybe not a bad idea.
Exactly.
Hopefully it was the wood, not the stuff he was putting
on
the wood.
Well, I'm sure it was. Yeah, it's just
very nice. So two recent court cases are a good example of this. The first is of an attorney who obviously had a very robust law practice, and on the side, the lady wanted to do a documentary film, and she got liability insurance. She kept a separate bank account. She spent numerous hours on this project. She had no prior film experience, I don't believe, or maybe she did have a little bit, but she wasn't an expert in the field. And this was allowed because she just kept proper documentation and ran it like a business. Second court case, just the opposite. A person was a photographer. All they did was photography, but they did not run it like a business, did not keep separate accounts, and the loss that they wanted to recognize on that was disallowed because it was deemed a hobby. And that's the tax investigator today.
Well, hey, let me ask you a question about a hobby. If you're doing a hobby, at the point that you make a profit, then it goes from a hobby to a business. Is that what you're saying?
That's right.
So as long as you're losing money, how many years can you go starting a business and losing money and be allowed to continue to write that off?
Well, as long as you have a profit motive indefinitely, as long as it's a business and you meet these nine circumstantial tests, then you can continue to write that off. You may get audited. They may come and ask you, hey, you got to prove that this is not a hobby. But as long as
even if you're not a Tea Party member and have a 403C nonprofit, they may still audit you?
That's a deep question, Jack.
That's deep thoughts. Yeah, I think, yeah. Okay, so you can get audited, but you can get audited for anything.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always thought it was very funny when people used to say that, you know, the things you never want to hear is, hi, I'm from the IRS and I'm here to help you. Yeah, oh, that sounds good. Well, listen, we're going to take a quick break and we're going to come back with Carl Jepson and Carl's comments. You're listening to Investing Simplified. If you want to join in on the fun conversation, give us a call at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. And I'll tell you a little hint here. What you don't know can hurt you. And sometimes a question you may ask may help another listener. So give us a call and ask us a question. If you have something on your mind about legal, taxes, or investing, give us a call on Investing Simplified. We'll be right back with Carl's comments. I got the shivers in my knee bone,
shaking all over. When your legal rights and responsibilities are involved, you need attorneys you can trust. The attorneys at the Warren Allen Law Firm offer you solid legal advice and exceptional service. We practice in nearly all areas of law. We can help you with your legal needs, including wills, trusts, probate, contracts, real estate, construction, landlord rights, business, personal injury, divorce, bankruptcy, and civil litigation. The Warren Allen Law Firm has represented individuals and businesses for over three decades, and its nine attorneys have more than 200 years of combined experience practicing law. By combining experience and knowledge with individualized attention and prompt service, Warren Allen is the law firm to rely on when you are in need of legal representation. We are conveniently located at 850 Northeast 122nd Avenue near the I-205 and I-84 interchange. I'm Carl Jepson, partner with the Warren Allen Law Firm, and I invite you to contact us at 503-255-8795 or on the web at warrenallen.com.
Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepson, estate planning attorney and partner of the Warren Allen Law Firm, with Carl's comments. You can call Carl at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Here's Carl Jepson.
All right, send lawyers, guns, and money.
Well, welcome back to Investing Simplified, and we have lawyers, and some of us have money, I guess. But the other stuff, I don't know for this morning, but this is the time when we do Carl's comments. And that's usually when I like to talk about something that's come up in my practice over the last week or so. And, you know, one of the things that is very common, common discussion is the difference between living trusts and wills. And we usually then get into a subject of probate. But I think sometimes where it gets a little bit blurred is I think people, you know, hear the word probate and they kind of flinch and they say, oh my gosh, that's really bad. And then they think when they have a trust that the trustee doesn't have anything to do. And that isn't really true. And especially, I mean, it may be simpler than when they have to deal with a probate because it's not court supervised. Being a trustee can be somewhat more flexible. It doesn't have rigid time frames nor rigid formats that have to be followed. But the trustee still has a lot of fiduciary duties that have to be carried out. And so today I thought I'd talk about a couple of things, both legal and practical. The first being practical, I want to talk about 15 things a trustee should do within the first 30 days of the date of the decedent's death. And these are very pragmatic kinds of things, not necessarily legal requirements. Some of them might be sort of legal requirements. But they're the kinds of things that you know, it takes some time, it takes some real effort. And so I'm just going to start with those. First thing, the trustee usually has to complete the funeral and burial stuff. I mean, they're usually the one that ends up doing it. They're usually the personal representative. They're usually the same person that is charged with the responsibility of being the manager of whatever's going on. So it's important that they take care of that probably is the first thing that they have to do. And the second thing they have to do is order extra death certificates. The death certificate is the key to almost every transaction that takes place after the decedent's death. No one's going to give you almost anything from the estate until you have that death certificate. And you want a bunch of them, depending on how many assets there are. And you usually get that through, order them when you go through the funeral process. And that usually the funeral home will ask you if you want extras. Tell them yes, depending on, you know, if you know much about the estate, tell them you want, you know, whatever you think you're going to need. You can always get more, but it's always good to get them early on. Third thing, secure the decedent's home and papers. If he lived in an apartment, you know, get it secure, get the papers. If he lived in a house, secure the house, get in there, you know, and make sure that you get through his papers so that you can find if there are will, you know, if his estate planning papers are there. Does he have lists of creditors? Does he have asset statements? You know, all that kind of stuff. You know, start gathering that together so that you have something to work with, and don't let that get away from you. Then the next thing you really need to do is to make sure that you get his mail or her mail forwarded to you, because that will help you discover not only assets, but it'll also help you to discover creditors, if there are any. Then the thing that you really need to do is, if there's a trust, you need to read that trust. And I mean, read it carefully, because you can often go off in the wrong direction. And don't be in a hurry to take care of everything, because administration of trust and administration of probate, no matter what you do, takes some time. Don't willy-nilly start, you know, giving stuff away, because even if it's inconsistent, if it's consistent with the trust, because you might not know what else is lurking in that estate that you need to deal with, and you as the trustee have a personal responsibility to administer the trust in accordance with the trust terms. And if you basically are highly negligent in doing what you do and it ends up losing some money, you could be personally responsible for it. So you really got to be cautious in that. So it's important. Next thing you want to consider doing is make a preliminary inventory. After you've looked at the papers and you've seen what's there, you know, if there's a whole bunch of bank accounts, list the bank accounts. If there's, you know, statements from brokerages, list them, and the name of the people and their addresses. Compile a list so that you can, and a estimated value. The statements will tell you that. If there's real estate, you should find out where the addresses are at least, and you might even check with the assessor's office and get the tax assessed value for the real property so that you can have that as part of your asset list. So prepare kind of a preliminary inventory. I'm not talking about counting the bottle caps in the drawer underneath the sink. I'm talking about, you know, the big stuff, and have a kind of an asset list that you can have at least in your mind, so that, because that makes a lot of decisions, may make a lot of differences to the decisions you have to make.
Keeping those monthly statements for the month that the person passed away is a very valuable thing, because I know you use them on your side of things to help establish value, and I know we use them to help allocate income for tax purposes before and after the date of death.
Absolutely. And so it's really important that date of death set of statements, both of income and expenses, is a good thing to have. And sometimes, you know, not every decedent has kept their records that well, so that gives you a bit more challenge. But that's one of the reasons. Then the next thing I think you do, you make sure that the mail gets forwarded to you, so that you may find that you don't have the statements for a couple of months, but now you're getting statements from someplace and you're saying, well, gosh, where are those other ones? And you want to find out what happened to them. After you got all that stuff done and you've done your preliminary inventory and you've made like a preliminary list of creditors, then you should make an appointment with a CPA and you should make an appointment with an attorney and have them tell you what you should, you know, what they're looking at. That way, by that time, you're able to tell them, you know, kind of what the estate's more or less about. You provide them with the estate planning papers, and you tell them, this is what it looks like right now. Maybe there's some more, but right now it looks like I got this much money and it looks like I got this much property. And then they'll be able to, you know, give you more precise instructions about various things that you might have to do. Number 10 is generally, it's not on all estates, but almost all, you want to get an EIN number, an employee identification number for the estate or the trust, as the case may be. If you have a taxable state, that may be a little bit more complicated because there may be more than one involved. There may be two trusts or three, even depending on how it's structured. But nonetheless, at least be prepared to get that. It's not a big deal. You can do it online, but it is important. Or you can leave that up to the CPA or the attorney to do that. But it is important because then once you have that, you probably should go and open a bank account for the estate where all of the estate expenses come out of, and then it can be in an institution that you're already using or that the decedent was already using, or it could be a new bank, whichever you want to do. But anyway, you open that with the new EIN, and you can cash out. You know, say it's a bank account with U.S. You could cash it out in U.S. and then open one right there with a new EIN number as the trust account. Or you could just cash it out entirely and walk over to Wells Fargo or whatever other bank you like, Riverview or any of those, or you know, wherever you're comfortable. And then you can deposit that money into those accounts and then get a checkbook. Do not get a debit card. Do not ever take cash out of there. Just use no debit cards. Tell them no. Tell them you'll cut them up. They send you one, throw it away. First cut it up. Anyway, so you should have that and make sure that they have a way to provide you with at least electronic images of all the checks that go through that, and use checks. I know people are used to paying things online and all that stuff. Don't do that with an estate. Make sure there's a paper trail for every penny you spend. So you do that with your bank account. Then after you've gone through all the paperwork, make a list of all the beneficiaries that are named in the trust, including the ones that are contingent beneficiaries. People, in other words, if it says, I give all my stuff to John Jones, but if he dies before I do or dies before the full administration of the trust, then I give the rest to XYZ charity or you know, Billy Bob or whoever, and get a list of all those people and their address and contact information. You want to... I think you need to make an appointment with the financial institutions that are part of the trust within the town where you're, or the area where the decedent lived. Go down and tell them who you are, give them a copy of the trust, and ask them to make sure that any of those assets that can be transferred to the trust at that point should be transferred into the trust name. At least that way they'll have it as part of the estate account, so that when you liquidate that and distribute it to the beneficiaries, it'll leave a good paper trail. And also alerts them to the fact that the decedent's dead. Sometimes these financial institutions don't know for years, and it's a good idea that they get to know that. You need to notify the beneficiaries. I've seen a lot of trustees who kind of want to hide the ball. They don't want to tell the beneficiary stuff, but they have to. The law requires them to give some notification. And my recommendation is transparency, because the number one thing that'll get you sued as a trustee is to hide the ball and make it seem like you're just sneaking around. And the next thing you know, the beneficiaries are filing a lawsuit in court to have you removed and to provide an accounting, and then all of a sudden you've lost all of the benefits of the trusteeship, you might as well have started out with a probate in the first place. So that's a really good thing. The notice needs to tell them that you are the trustee, and this is important. If you're going to take compensation, for most trusts provide that you can take compensation. If you are going to take compensation, you should tell the beneficiaries how you are going to take your compensation and how much. In other words, are you doing it on an hourly basis? Are you doing a percentage basis? You need to discuss this with your do you have any special skills? All sorts of things. It's a very complex question, and you can ask your lawyer or you can ask your CPA about that as to what you might want to do. That way, then, when you've given them that notice, they know, they don't come back at the end of the day and you say, well, gosh, I've done all of this work and I should be paid this much money. And I wasn't going to charge anything, but you guys have been such a bunch of jerks that I'm going to charge you now. Well, now you already set it up in the outset that says I'm going to take compensation. If you're really not going to take compensation, then don't. You can tell them you're not going to. That's okay too. But anyway, it's a good idea. So then we're just about out of the list. Then the beneficiaries, you also need to tell them if the trust has become irrevocable. Many trusts, I would say most trusts, become irrevocable upon the death of the trustor, but not all of them, but a lot of them. You need to tell them if it is become irrevocable. And then you should tell them, I think, of your sort of preliminary understanding of what the trust is all about. Give them an estimate of the time that you think it's going to take you to get everything wound up and liquidated and distributed, with a strong caveat that you're not guaranteeing it. You're just saying, this, you know, I'm going to have to get this stuff done, and, you know, I'm working full-time, and so I'm going to have to do this nights and weekends, and it's going to be hard. So, you know, and I've got to get the attorney on board, and I got to get the CPA on board. So you know, you're not going to get your check tomorrow morning. It's just not going to happen, so don't bug me about it. Maybe that's not what you want to say, but that's kind of what you meant. So anyway, then after you've done all of that, you should sit down and you should organize your files and make sure that you have a file for your trust and estate planning documents. Make sure you have, at a minimum, a file for all of the asset documents. That would include subfiles with each account and with estate assets and, you know, real properties and all that kind of stuff. You'd want a file for your creditors. You want a file for trust expenses or estate expenses. And along with that, you want to have either a handwritten kind of journal where you're going to write down every expense and explain what it is, or have a Quicken program or an Excel spreadsheet or something, whatever you're comfortable with, so that you can identify everything there is. And also in that journal, you can write down your hours that you spent, the time that you're spending, and the tasks that you've performed, and how much time you spent doing it. That way, you'll have a foundation. If anybody ever challenges what you're charging as a trustee, that you'll have a way to at least say, well, look, this is what I've been doing, and this is why I, you know, charge that much money. So that's a good thing. And then you have a file for taxes, because there are always going to be some kind of taxes that you have to deal with. If nothing else, you're going to have to file the final tax return for the decedent. Sometimes you'll have to file a fiduciary tax return for the trust itself, or the estate, as the case may be, and all of those things need to be, you know, done within a reasonable period of time. That's kind of the practical side of it. The other part of it I like to talk about is, and I'm just going to hit one area, and that is sometimes trustees kind of like the power that they think they have, and they get really in a big hurry, and they want to do it their way, and that's their way, and they you know, everybody else be darned. And that's not a good thing. And so I wanted to just read you something from the law. I'm going to read the law. That's a novel concept for a lawyer. But anyway, first of all, this is called duty to administer the trust. This is found in the Oregon Uniform Trust Code, and it's the very beginning of the powers and duties of the trustee. And it says, upon acceptance of a trusteeship, the trustee shall administer the trust in good faith, in accordance with its terms and purposes, and the interests of the beneficiaries, and in accordance with this chapter. So it's got to be in accordance with the trust, in accordance with good faith, and in accordance with the law. Then this is perhaps the most thing. This is called the duty of loyalty, and that talks about a whole lot of other things, but the fundamental aspect of the trust is a trustee shall administer the trust solely in the interests of the beneficiaries. So that means that if you're not a beneficiary, it's everybody else's money, not yours. And it means that you have to administer it. You can't be lording it over the beneficiaries just because you have control of the checkbook. You need to take their interests into consideration in managing that trust. And this is one of the areas where people get really in trouble, because they start making arbitrary decisions which may have very logical and reasonable reasons behind them, but they end up making beneficiaries really mad because they don't understand or whatever. And so it's very, very important to think about how this relates to the interests of the beneficiaries when you're administering the trust. And then ultimately you're gonna get to the point where you can distribute all of the assets to the beneficiaries, and you can, you know, cease being the trustee.
Is that power corrupts absolutely?
I think so. Sometimes it does.
You know, we've had several callers call in here, Carl, on our show with a question about where a trustee of a trust, one of the beneficiaries, called in a couple times and said, you know, they're not getting any accounting from the trustee, and the trustee doesn't want to share anything. At some point, from a legal standpoint, the cost versus the gain is not there because of the cost of a costly court trial or whatever.
Well, absolutely. And one of the things that the problem with doing that, the hide the ball kind of thing, is, and the other thing is, it's a lot of work. to get together and find out what all the assets are and how much they're worth and where they are and all of that stuff and what the credit are, it takes a lot of effort. And depending on the estate. Now, some people are very, very well organized, or maybe they have just a handful of assets. You know, in the situation where they've got a couple of bank accounts and a house or something, well, it's not so hard to do. But if they have quite a diverse set of assets or maybe some significant credit problems, or if they have like rental properties, it can be really challenging and complex to figure out what's going on there. But if you hide the ball, and the beneficiaries, they have a right to know. You have to keep them reasonably informed. That's the basic rule. And in order to do that, you need to be able to tell them that at least on an annual basis, and you have to be able to tell them what the assets were when you got them, what assets you've disposed of and how much you got, what expenses you've paid, and you know what they were, and you know if you got any income. You know, where did it come from and where is it now? I mean, kind of basic, you know, where's the money? You know, follow the money. And you have to be able to provide documentation. That's why I mentioned those kind of basic categories of files or however you want to keep that information. But if someone gets mad at you as you're doing your trusteeship, the first thing that the beneficiary's lawyer who files the lawsuit against you is going to say is, we want an accounting. And if you haven't been doing that stuff, it is a big piece of work to go and reconstruct it after the fact.
So they're going to say, show me the money.
It's going to be, show me the money. And they're going to want to know, yeah, they're going to want to, and if you can't show exactly where it went, then you got a problem, because then they're going to want to see your checking account and your bank account, because they're going to want to compare that with the money that came out of the trustee's account. So it's very important to, you know, do this, and you can't do it in a cavalier manner. So that's it for Carl's comments today.
Okay, well, if you've got a question, give us a call, 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. We have a couple lines open. Give us a call. We're going to take a quick break, and I'm going to come right back with a little stock report. You're listening to Investing Simplified.
This is Kevin Stege, shareholder with Baker & Coulson Certified Public Accountants, serving the Portland and Southwest Washington areas for almost 40 years. We are a full-service accounting and consulting firm offering our services to a wide range of business and individual clients. One of the largest expenses to a household or a business is its tax burden. While off-the-shelf tax products can help file simple returns, they can't know your plans for the future and not only provide insight and planning to help you get there, but actually help you along the way. There are just some things that can't be replaced by experience. Whether you are just beginning your working career or have a well-established business with many employees, rely on the professionals at Baker & Coulson to help in an efficient, accurate, and personalized manner. We're located at 2414 Northeast Division in Gresham and can be reached at our website at bakercoulson.com or 503-666-5569. That's bakercoulson.com, 503-666-5569. And remember, at Baker & Coulson, our service is the product our clients remember most.
Get your investing and estate planning questions answered now. You can email Chuck at askchuck@pfgwm.com. That's askchuck@pfgwm.com. Or you can call him right now at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626.
Well, you're listening to Investing Simplified on a wonderful Saturday morning here in beautiful Portland, Oregon. And I do want to mention, if you haven't went to my website, www.pfgwm.com, you can go on there. It's got some great videos that you can watch about all the way from investing to estate planning. And I highly recommend you do it. I also have replays of our radio show on there. And we do have a caller with a question here, and so we're going to grab that. And the caller is Steve. Steve, are you on the line?
Good morning.
Good morning. And you've got a question for Kevin on taxes?
On unemployment benefits.
Okay.
Taxation of benefits, I should say.
Okay.
It was announced, I believe it was yesterday, by the Department of Labor that the Boeing employees in Seattle, and actually nationwide, Boeing's gone ahead and outsourced some of their 787 manufacturing to China and also to Russia. And it was mentioned in the article that anybody that was displaced by Boeing for the last 18 months or the next 18 months would receive 2.5 years of unemployment benefits, $25,000 worth of education, re-education benefits, if you will, moving expenses, and actually be reimbursed for looking for jobs outside the area. I know unemployment benefits are taxable, but all the other benefits that they mentioned there, they're also taxable.
The other benefits being education benefits and what was the other?
Moving.
Oh,
They're willing to reimburse you 90% of your expenses involved in looking for a job outside the area and 90% of your expenses in moving to that job.
Mm-hmm. Well, reimbursements typically are not taxable. So I haven't particularly heard of exactly what you're talking about that came through yesterday. And so usually it's good to look at what each plan like this entails. But something like this, in general, the moving reimbursements would not be taxable if you have proper documentation to show that, hey, these were my expenses, they reimbursed me. Obviously, you don't get a deduction on your tax return because you got reimbursed, so that should be okay. And then re-education expenses, if they are reimbursing, that could be a job non-taxable benefit. That does occur, that there is a reimbursement program for something like that, and so that also would be non-taxable. If it's just in the form of a lump sum to help cover those costs, that very well could be a severance, a taxable severance type of transaction. But I wouldn't think they would go that route. I'm pretty sure that they would run it through a qualified program to make those two items non-taxable.
Well, I'd say if the government issues a check, it's not really a severance. It'd just be a reimbursement, wouldn't it?
Exactly right. Just a reimbursement and wouldn't be reported at all. So that would be a very good thing for the employee.
Okay. Good to know.
Thanks, Steve. Thank you. We got another caller on the line. Lee's got a question about trust. Lee, are you there?
Yes.
Hi, Lee.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How about you?
Oh, pretty good. Yeah, my question is, my dad set up a trust, a revocable trust, years ago, and it was for the benefit of my stepmother. And so all these years we've been paying her expenses out of it. Okay, she just died, and the beneficiaries, there's 5 siblings. My question is, when we're able to disperse all the funds that are in there, and we're only about $200,000 among 5 siblings, is that money taxable? Because it's in a trust.
It shouldn't be taxable, generally speaking. That would be part of an inheritance, is basically what it would be. The only exception to that might be if some of those assets were like a 401k or an IRA
or an
annuity, then there would be an income tax component that would be basically, I think usually they run it through to the individual beneficiaries if they're distributed, and the individual beneficiaries would pay whatever income tax that their portion of the distribution, you know, was attributable to, rather than pay it out of the trust itself, because the trust will usually pay a much higher rate than the individual. So, but other than that, generally, if it's just, say, it's a savings account, or, you know, you got a bank account and it's sitting there and it's got $200,000 in it, and you divided that by, you know, by 5, you know, you're gonna have no taxable income on that at all, and at that size, if that's the whole estate, you're not going to have any estate tax either.
Yeah, the only other asset is the trust owns 2/3 of a house. So when that house is sold, the 2/3 profit, whatever it may be, will also be divided.
That's correct. And there again, it might be prudent if it's going to be on the market for a while, and sometimes those part interest in houses can be challenging, depending on, you know, if the 1/3 person doesn't want to sell, you might it might be problematic. But if everybody wants to sell, then it's not such a big deal. If it's sold within a reasonable time, because you get a stepped up basis on the thing, but if you held on to that house for a long time, or I assume it's a house, then and then sold it later, that could conceivably be some capital gain based on the appreciation in value from the date of death to the date of sale. But ordinarily, there, you know, if it's sold fairly quickly right after the death, it usually doesn't doesn't involve any kind of inheritance tax or income tax.
Right. Yeah. The trust, like I said, is set up. It's just like a portfolio. It's invested money and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So. Anyway.
Well, that's a situation where the trust works really well, and there's not that much to do because you don't have the kinds of issues that give rise to generally disputes and things like that. I mean, it sounds like it's pretty clear cut, but nonetheless, it's important to get it done correctly.
Correct. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You bet.
Great. Thanks. Bye. Those were two great calls, and that's one of the things our listeners out there. This is a great opportunity for you to call and get a question answered for free. And both those calls, I think, provided some very good information. And that's what our show is all about. Speaking about that, I want to get back to my website about www.pfgwm.com. You go on there, we also have replays of our shows. And if you missed our July 13th interview with Harry Dent, I got to tell you, I think that's a great show for you to listen to. And at least the first half of it, we had Harry on as a guest. And speaking about that, on August 24th, we're going to have Harry's co-editor on the show with us, Rodney Johnson, who's been with Harry for a long, long time. And him and Harry Dent both write the free newsletter, Survive and Prosper. And you can sign up and get a copy of that at www.harrydent.com. Pretty easy to do. And both you guys sign up for it. What do you think about it?
Great. Yeah, I think it's neat.
It's a very good read.
Yeah, they got some great stuff, and it's nothing really too technical. I mean, it's some pretty good common sense approach to the economy.
Well, he's got a section in there. I believe it's Pathway to Dow 3300, and it's not their detailed analysis and recommendations, but he does give what he would do between 2012 and 2015. What he would do from 2015 to 17 to 22 during this time frame of when he sees this correction. And so it's food for thought.
Yeah, absolutely. Nobody has a crystal ball. Nobody can totally predict what's going to happen in the marketplace. And I think one of the things Harry Dent and also the people who wrote the book Aftershock, which we talked about on the show numerous times, both those people predicted what was going to happen in 2008. The problem is Harry gets slammed a lot because Harry said the Dow could go down to 3,000, and it only went down to 6,700. But, the thing is the news people always go after that 3,300 or whatever number was he said. And the fact that we had a substantial decline, that's what we had. We've got another caller on the line. We've got Laura with a question about IRAs. Laura, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
So my question is, my husband and I would like to set up a Roth IRA. We don't have any sort of retirement account set up. And so my question is, how do we go about setting it up? And I've heard that with Roth IRAs, it can act like a savings account because the principal that you put in, you can take out without any penalties. Is that true?
That's correct. Most people don't know that the original contribution that you make, you can always take back out even the next day, no penalty. So that's absolutely right. It's a very good account to use even as a savings account. Just can't touch the earnings.
Okay, yeah, that's what I had heard, and I wanted to be sure that was correct. And then how do I go about setting that up? And then because we don't have a retirement account, I don't know. I guess people invest the money in their retirement accounts, and how would I go about doing that?
Well, the question I would ask is, what tax bracket are you and your husband in?
So I'm not sure what bracket we're in, but we make about $50,000 a year.
Together?
Yeah, together.
Yeah. Do you have any children?
Yes.
Okay, and you're obviously buying a home, so you got some write-off?
Yes.
Okay, so Kevin, they're probably in a minimum tax bracket, wouldn't you say?
Yes, so that would be a Roth account. Kind of sounds like it would probably make sense. And you can set up a Roth through any financial institution. Obviously, Chuck can set them up. You can do a self-directed one. The Roth account is just a shell. What you actually invest your money in or want your money invested in, there's a wide range of investment options. So it's...
You know, Laura, one of the things I would ask you from a financial planning standpoint is, do you and your husband have about 3 to 6 months of savings set aside for emergencies in case one of you gets sick or one of you, you know, loses your job or something? Do you have some reserves set up?
We do, and that's okay. What I would like to put into the Roth. So it would have to be put into something safe. I don't want it in any
investments. What I would do is I would go to the bank, and I would set it up in a bank, either money market or CD right now until you know, kind of things stabilize a little bit for you. And once you build that up to maybe $20,000 or so, then you've got a little flexibility. But I would go right to the bank or credit union. And a lot of the credit unions have some very good plans that you can put into. And a Roth would make sense at this point for you guys with a young family just starting out. It'd be a great way to set some money aside.
Okay. Thank you. And I forgot what I was going to ask now. I had another question.
Well, I would recommend, like Chuck was saying, either use the bank that you bank at, or like Charles Schwab has a very easy online self-directed where you can just open an account online, transfer, you know, cut a check or even do an online transfer, and then you can choose where that gets invested, just in their money market, or you can start, you know, buying Facebook stock if you want. I'm sure Chuck.
Yeah,
I'm kidding.
I really wouldn't recommend that for you guys just getting started. I'd do it at a bank or a credit union. I wouldn't go into a Schwab account.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want you losing any of it.
Could I do a money market within a Roth account?
Absolutely. You could do it at your bank or credit union. You bet.
Okay. Yeah. I will do that.
Yep.
Then thank you so much. And then also about trusts.
Yes.
So I don't know, because we have such, you know, a small estate and everything, if that's the way to go. What do you recommend?
Well, quite frankly, at this age, I would probably say no. I think the cost of the trust is going to exceed the value to you. When you get into middle age and your kids get grown up and stuff, and you have some stuff saved up, then that would be a good idea to take a look at it then.
Okay. Well,
Laura, thank you very much. It was a great call. Good questions. Certainly a will for them, though, Carl.
Absolutely a will. Yeah,
absolutely a will.
You want to make sure you got a will.
Listen, thank you very much for calling today. This is Investing Simplified. We got all the calls at the end of the show, but we'll be back next Saturday to Investing Simplified at 8 to 9. We'll be back.
Price Financial Group Wealth Management. We do investing simplified.
Let's face it, the rules of retirement have changed. What we were told to do just a few years ago now seems like a pipe dream. Hi, this is Michael Burnett for Chuck Price, owner of Price Financial Group Wealth Management. You know the drill. Be a loyal employee. You'll get a pension. Your home will be worth 10 to 20 times what you paid for it when you retire. So how's that working for you? Call Chuck Price right now. He's located right here in Portland. Featured expert on Investing Simplified on AM 970. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or close to retiring, and he focuses on protection of principal and tax strategies to minimize your taxes. Call right now and get Chuck's retirement report. It's packed full of information on generating more income during retirement, how to leave more to your heirs, and so much more. 503-253-3000. Chuck Price, Price Financial Group Wealth Management, on the web at pfgwm.com.